This program is called The Untrained Eye. Over in London, there's a group that has a good time insisting that no matter what anybody says, the Earth is actually flat. Back in the 1960s, when the United States sent its first orbiter around the Earth, it sent back pictures, and the American ambassador thought it would be fun to have the head of the English Flat Earth Society come over and look at them. That gentleman was very kind about it. He came over, he looked at the pictures, he said how great they were, and then he said, "It is amazing how, to the untrained eye, the Earth looks round." What was so funny about this was that he was making fun of experts. Every time an expert is shown to be dead wrong by common sense, his response is always, "Well, that's the way it looks to the untrained eye. Only an expert like me understands why what you consider reality doesn't make sense." We say this around us all the time. Whenever people crack down on crime, crime goes down. In Europe, the big drive has been getting rid of the death penalty and being kind to criminals and outlawing guns. We had the same thing in the United States in the 1960s, and Europe is experiencing exactly what we did. The crime rate in Europe is going out of sight. Everybody falls down and worships, especially the respectable conservatives, when somebody mentions diversity. Now, diversity is an unqualified disaster. And any person with common sense can see that. In Europe, once again, the crime rate is going out of sight. They've had chronic unemployment, so they're bringing in millions of immigrants from the third world, and they call it diversity, and they say it's good. They don't give any reason for it. People keep pointing out that it's an unqualified disaster, and their response is, "Yes, to the untrained eye, it looks like an unqualified disaster." So this program is dedicated to the untrained eye. To the untrained eye that sees silliness, facts, and reality.
Let's say that you asked any 12-year-old who has been homeschooled the following question. There is a country, you would say, where all criticism of the government is outlawed. Now tell me, is that a free country? And the homeschooler would say, "Of course that's not a free country." Some years back, I could have said you could ask any 12-year-old that question, and you would get the same answer. Of course that's not a free country. Well, we all know how the public schools are these days. If you ask a college graduate today, if a country outlaws all criticism of the government, is it a free country? He would probably say, "Well, it depends on what the criticism is." But people who have not been brainwashed at college will generally recognize that a country where all criticism of the government is outlawed is not a free country. And in fact, that was one of the first crises that the American government faced. The first political party in American history was the Federalist Party. George Washington was elected president as the leader of what was later called the Federalist Party, but he denied it was a party at all, since he got all the electoral votes, and he opposed political parties. But when his successor, John Adams, was elected, it was pretty well recognized that the Federalist Party was a party. In 1798, the Federalist Party won a terrific victory where they controlled both houses of Congress as well as the presidency, and they passed the Alien and Sedition Acts. The Alien and Sedition Acts said that anyone who criticized the federal government was subject to imprisonment, and a lot of people were, in fact, imprisoned for criticizing the federal government. Today, everyone would say, "Well, the Supreme Court would take care of that, because only the Supreme Court protects freedom of speech." Actually, at the time, the Supreme Court did not have the sole power to interpret the Constitution. And oddly enough, it was the people of the United States who got rid of this tyranny. In 1800, largely because of the Alien and Sedition Acts, the Federalist Party was destroyed at the polls. It had controlled the country before that. After that, it went into steady decline, largely because of those acts. So the American people, oddly enough, were capable of rescuing freedom of speech, even if they had to reject George Washington's own party. And they rescued it from the Alien and Sedition Acts, which said that criticism of government was the same thing as hatred of the government. Today, criticism, under political correctness, is considered the same thing as hate. It's just that it's not the same criticism of the same people, but it's exactly the same as the Alien and Sedition Acts. Criticizing minorities, criticizing liberal assumptions, these things are enough to get you ruined professionally. In every country outside of the United States, they can actually get you fined or jailed. It's still the same thing. It is the argument that criticism is the same thing as hatred. This idea that criticism is the same thing as hatred has always been the greatest enemy of freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is not just the right to say anything that doesn't hurt anybody's feelings, to say anything that doesn't offend any powerful groups. Freedom of speech, in fact, is the opposite. Freedom of speech is the right to say things that offend people, that are directly contrary to the accepted truths of the society. As I have said, if freedom of speech just means the right to say anything that doesn't offend anybody, then every slave in the Old South had freedom of speech. Every black slave in the Old South was allowed to say anything that didn't offend his master and that didn't offend anybody. That's not freedom of speech. The right to criticize is the freedom of speech. The right to criticize harshly is freedom of speech. The right to say things that hurt people's feelings and hurt people's feelings badly is freedom of speech. If you don't have that right, you are not free. Liberals and respectable conservatives are always talking about hate. But as Joe Sobrin pointed out, the reason that so many liberals talk about hate so much is precisely because they do a lot of hating. They look upon their opponent as evil. They look upon white people, Americans, any group that I belong to, as hateful bigots. Southerners are hateful bigots. White Southerners are hateful bigots. Black Southerners who go to church are religious bigots. They're surrounded by evil people. Therefore, they do an awful lot of hating. If you think that you're perfectly right and everybody else is perfectly wrong, you're going to do a lot of hating. That's the way the world works. I've done a lot of interrogation. And one thing you learn in interrogation is that if you let someone talk, they will talk about other people. But the person they really tell you all about is themselves. In politics and as an interrogator, I made one observation which was very critical to my own survival. That observation was that a person who uses the word liar and lie a lot in his conversation is someone whose word you cannot trust. And I have never yet found an exception to that rule. To a person who values the truth, the word lie is a very, very large word. A lie is an intentional misstatement. It is an intentional statement that is not factual. It's not entirely accidental that the commandment says, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. It does not say, thou shalt not lie. If someone is worried about their looks and you say, well, you look fine, that is a lie, if you don't believe it, but it is certainly not bearing false witness against your neighbor. Certain practicality there. We all tell intentional untruths. An intentional untruth that hurts someone is bearing false witness against your neighbor. That is a violation of decency, and, as it happens, it's also a violation of the commandment, which does not say, thou shalt not lie. So someone who uses the word hate a great deal, does a great deal of hating. A mature person learns that there's a reason why another person does bad things, does evil things. I personally do not believe that it is my job to provide abstract justice. By that I mean, I would be perfectly willing to pull the switch myself, personally, and I know I can from my early experiences, on a serial killer. What I am not capable of doing is hating that serial killer. The reason I would pull the switch is so that he would not kill other people. Let me restate that. I would pull a switch so that other people would not be killed. I am not trying to prevent him from committing sins. I am trying to prevent other people from being hurt. There's a vast difference here. I am not providing justice. I am providing prevention. I am not doing this to him because he deserves it. I'm doing it because it is the right thing to do. There's a huge difference between this and my being the arbiter of justice. I have a responsibility to prevent this person from hurting other people. That's because I'm human too. A cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church, which is, of course, a little redundant. There aren't any cardinals outside of the bird who are not Catholic, was born and raised in Columbia, South Carolina, my hometown. Someone wrote an article which was very favorable to him, but it included a statement that he had suffered the bigotry of being raised in the Southern Bible Belt, the Protestant Bible Belt, even though he was a Catholic. Now, normally, a Southerner who makes good and wants to appeal to the northern suburbanites will be happy to join in any criticism of the South. But this gentleman still had some of his roots, even though he was a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church, a sophisticate. He actually got upset at that statement, and he pointed out that, yes, he had been raised in the overwhelmingly Protestant Bible Belt, but his home state had never shown the slightest bigotry toward him or his religion, and he resented the insult to the place that he still regarded as home. Well, this made me feel very good. I was grateful to him. But it is true that in the Deep South, it was always expected that different people belonged to different churches. Bernard Baruch, whose father was in the Confederate Army, was a Jew raised in Camden, South Carolina. His family moved to New York City when he was just reaching his teens. And he said the first time that he ever ran into anti-Semitism was his first day in New York City. In the South, different people went to different churches. He went to a synagogue. Nobody thought much of it, since everybody did go to different churches. The South, the Deep South at least, in my experience, inside the population, has very little religious bigotry. Now, there was a very strong political bigotry against the Catholic Church, particularly in the 1928 election when Al Smith was the first Catholic to run for president. However, it should be kept in mind that at that time, the Pope himself was very much against any tolerance for other religions. This frightened people in the United States. The official doctrine of the Catholic Church in 1928, in fact, denounced freedom of religion anywhere. So this was not exactly a one-way street. To bring this down to a more local level, when I was about 4 years old, way out in the sand hills, we used to go to a grocery store, a tiny little grocery store that was run by a Christian Zionist. Nobody questioned his right to be a Christian Zionist or anything else he wanted to be, but once he actually became abusive to my father about the fact that my father was getting various shots for his children. The storekeeper, I guess he was in a bad mood that day, actually became abusive about it, about how my father was depending on man's medicines rather than God's cures in the form of Christian Science. My father then, who had never questioned the man's religion, said, "Well, you're a Christian Scientist, but you're wearing glasses, false teeth, and a hearing aid. He said, if you really believe that God will take care of all that sort of thing, why don't you take out your false teeth? Why don't you take off your hearing aid and take off your glasses? Well, that took care of the case. And today, I'm sure that my father's remark would be considered bigotry and hate, and my father would have been Adolf Hitler and so forth and so on. But all he was doing was pointing out that the grocery owner, despite his religious faith, was just a person, a human being, and he had no right to expect my father to follow his beliefs. So while today you're not allowed to say things like that, it was still true, and for once, it was not my father being the aggressive one. In fact, they got along fine before that and after that. It was just an incident between two friends. The point I'm making is that a mature person does not hate other people because of who they are, but he does treat them as if they are who they are. If someone is a career criminal, I think he should be in prison. Actually, there are places where they could be isolated a lot cheaper than a prison. But the only reason I would want them to suffer at all would be if they were going to be let out, so that they would realize that the next time they do something to somebody, it's going to hurt. That's because they're human beings. All this seems logical to me, but it seems that everybody keeps getting justice mixed up with prevention. And they're two entirely different things. I am not the arbiter of justice. My job is to protect other human beings from harm. Now, the title that I had in mind for this program was Quakers Call the Cops. This is not intended as a slam at Quakers, although I do have some grudges against Quakers as a group. In fact, at my age, it's a little hard for me to think of any group as a group that I don't have some grudges against. I know an awful lot. And when you know an awful lot, especially when you know an awful lot about people, especially when you've spent your life in politics, you learn something bad about just about every group. You also learn something good about pretty well every group. Once again, this sounds like ABCs, but people don't think about it enough. So a Quaker is supposed to be glorious because he does not believe in committing violence. Please note that verb, committing. On the other hand, while he would never put a gun in his own lily-white little hand, he will call an armed policeman who has a gun in his not-so-lily-white little hand to defend said Quaker. Now, morally, I have a certain difficulty telling the difference between having a cop shoot somebody and shooting somebody yourself. This is a big deal to a Quaker. Benjamin Franklin was born in Boston, Massachusetts. He moved to Pennsylvania at an early age, alone. And, of course, that is the Quaker state, Pennsylvania, or it was the Quaker state, set up by William Penn to be a refuge for Quakers. And since then Franklin chose to spend his life there, obviously the domination of the Quakers didn't make the place unlivable. But Ben Franklin did have a tendency to be a bit of an iconoclast, and as a good American, he resented all authority. He resented the Puritan Church in Massachusetts. He would have resented the Anglican Church when it was established, the established church in Virginia. Well, it happened that the dominant church in the Quaker state was the Friends, the Quakers. So naturally, in his autobiography, Ben Franklin, being Ben Franklin, had some very acid remarks to make about Quakers. This is especially interesting to me because I have never seen anybody have an acid remark to make about Quakers, except for Ben Franklin. I am willing to bet good money that every single American who is listening to this program, when the word Quaker is mentioned, thinks about the picture of that smiling, rosy-faced Quaker who is on the front of Quaker Oats. That's what we all think about. We don't know anything much about Quakers unless we are one. The actual name of the Quakers, of course, is the Society of Friends, but the actual name of the Lutheran Church is the Evangelical Church. Luther would turn over in his grave if he heard his church called the Lutheran Church. The British Conservative Party calls itself the Tories. Tory was a name given them by their opposition. It really meant an Irish highwayman, an armed robber. But as time passed, they were proud of the name, and they adopted it. Quakers have adopted that name for themselves. They don't mind it. In fact, just about every group in America now calls itself something that they were once attacked as being. For example, the Methodist Church, in which I was raised, hated the word Methodist. People made fun of them because John Wesley gave them all a method of doing everything, and the word Methodist was an insult. Yankee Doodle was a song which was written to make fun of Americans by a Britisher when the American Revolution started. And it wasn't but a year or two before Americans were proudly playing Yankee Doodle Dandy. Yankee Doodle went to town riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his cap and called it macaroni. Macaroni meant high-classed, so they were describing an idiot. But the Americans took it in such good style that they adopted it. And if you look at the Mormons, for example, Jesus Christ's Church of Latter-day Saints, its a special holy book is the Book of Mormon. And so people, in order to insult them, kept calling them Mormons, and they eventually became proud of the name Mormon. Once you overcome your feelings of inferiority, you're glad to call yourself by the name that the other side insults you with. That's a very American thing, or maybe I should say a very Anglo-Saxon thing, since the British Tories and the Whigs, Whig, by the way, originally meant a Scottish highwayman, highway robber, and the Liberal Party was calling itself very proudly the Whigs. And of course, in the United States, we called ourselves Whigs when we were in rebellion, and there was a Whig party in America. Pennsylvania proudly calls itself the Quaker State. When William Penn was alive, calling it the Quaker colony would have upset him terribly. But being Americans, we're proud of what we are, and so we just adopt it, which is the ultimate form of revenge. So the Quakers that Ben Franklin talked about, probably at that time, didn't appreciate him calling them Quakers, and I think that his autobiography would not be published today because it contained criticisms of Quakers. The criticisms were not all that vicious. What it accused Quakers of being was human beings. He gave one example where William Penn and one of his colleagues and a young man, a young Quaker, were on a ship from England to America, and a ship was coming, and they thought it was a pirate ship. So the young man ran up and helped to man the cannon. William Penn and the other Quaker congratulated the young man on doing that when they thought it was a pirate ship. As soon as they found out it was not a pirate ship, they berated the young man for violating his vow Quaker doctrine of nonviolence. The point that Franklin was making was that when threatened, Quakers, like any other human being, have a strong tendency to get a little hypocritical. They start thinking in terms of self-defense. Franklin was particularly upset with the Quakers because they used their nonviolence as an excuse not to spend money on defense. Once, when they absolutely had to defend the colony of Pennsylvania, they managed to get through a resolution to spend money on gunpowder by saying, this money is appropriated for wheat and other grain. Gunpowder was referred to as grain at the time. And since Franklin had been in the mountains of Pennsylvania and he had seen the suffering of the non-Quakers up there from the attacks of the Indians, and he knew that many of these rich Quakers were using their pacifism as an excuse not to send defensive forces up there to help the people on the frontier. This upset Ben Franklin a great deal. So that was why he was critical of the Quakers. Quakers were being people. He didn't hate Quakers. He did intensely resent using one's religion as an excuse not to spend money when people's lives were being threatened. By the way, I said that what we all think of, or at least, no, I'll say all of us Americans think about when we hear the word Quaker, unless we happen to be one, is that smiling, rosy-faced gentleman in the colonial hat on the front of Quaker Oats. There's a story behind that. Every religious group has, at one time or another, been persecuted and insulted. As I said, the word Methodist was originally an attack word. I honestly don't know what the Methodists called them before they called themselves Methodists, even though I was raised in the Methodist Church. It was always called Methodist. But Methodist was an insult originally. The last person hanged for refusing to obey an order in the British Navy was a young man who was a Methodist. He would not drink his ration of grog, his alcoholic beverage, and his captain ordered him to drink it. But being a Methodist, he said, "I cannot drink it." And believe it or not, this is about 1819, he ended up being hanged for not obeying the order to drink his grog. I guess that that one ended the whole business of hanging people for obeying anything less than battle orders, because it was a shameful incident. But it was a shameful incident against Methodists. And today, the idea that a Methodist is capable of being insulted is almost beyond belief. Well, there was a time when the Quakers were looked upon as sour-faced, strict people. And when the first Quaker Oats were produced, the picture on the box was a sour-faced old man chasing a bunch of kids with a stick in his hand. That picture stayed on there for quite a while. The Quakers, of course, objected to it, and eventually the picture was changed to the sweet-looking gentleman we were all raised with on the front of the Quaker Oats box. It's sort of like the pictures of Aunt Jemima when she was fat and looked like a servant in the kitchen, and since then she's been slimmed down and given a better look. In this case, the Quaker image was completely transformed, but it gives you some idea of the fact that the Quakers were not always looked upon as sweeties. It also gives you an understanding that Methodists were not always treated respectfully, or even that they always liked being called Methodists. But it never occurred to anybody in the Quaker state to outlaw Quaker Oats. There was the matter of freedom of speech, and though they were genuinely and rightfully offended, they knew very well that if they outlawed the other guy's freedom of speech, they would end up having their freedom of speech curtailed. And freedom of speech and freedom of religion was precisely what the Quaker state was founded for. In our day of political correctness, of course, the idea that a white Gentile could ever have been insulted, persecuted, or anything else is beyond belief, so this sort of thing is useful to remind people of. It is, of course, true that people who hate other people do tend to be a bit critical of them. It is not true that everybody who criticizes someone else hates them. You will find that some of the most hostile criticism you'll ever hear occurs inside of families, inside of loving families. If you took a little chart and said, who has criticized me most in my life when you're at the age of 20, you would find that probably your mother criticized you most. And most mothers don't hate their children. But it is true that in many cases, people criticize people they hate. For example, I think even in this politically correct age, I can say that the attitude of the average Jew towards Adolf Hitler is not one of unalloyed friendship and love. And Jews are, in fact, very critical of Adolf Hitler. And I think in that case, you could say that criticism goes with hatred. But the reason you don't jail every Jew for saying nasty things about Hitler or Nazis in general is because it's kind of assumed that Jews do not like Nazis, that Jews do not like Hitler. And I think if you tried to arrest a Jew for saying something nasty about Hitler because it reflected hate, you would probably be committed to some sort of very nice institution where they give you drugs until you get better. So it is true that hatred goes with criticism. It is not true that criticism always means hate unless you say that every mother hates her son. If you think that this is a very obvious point, I would remind you that any criticism of minority groups in any country outside the United States is considered a crime. Sometimes you go to prison for it in France and Germany. You go straight to prison, straight to jail, do not collect $200. In Canada, they just fine you and burn your book at your expense. And so this is a nutty policy because either these laws are insane or minority groups are simply incapable of error, while white people are incapable of anything but error. People who are incapable of error are not people. They're not human. So you have the interesting situation where political correctness regards minority groups as not human, and the really feverish haters regard minority groups as non-human. In other words, they agree, as so often happens with people who go completely nuts with their fanaticism. Once again, I must make an absolutely critical point. And if you never get anything else out of listening to me but this one point, your time will have been well spent and my time would have been well spent. That point is, if you want to know the person who lies the most, you find the person who accuses other people of lying. If you want to find the person who is the most vicious, sadistic, and the least merciful, find someone who keeps talking about mercy, mercy, mercy. The Inquisition, as I have pointed out before, would burn someone slowly alive while holding a cross in front of him on a long stick, but the inquisitors didn't want to get burned. And while that person screamed in agony, they would try to get him to renounce his heresy so that he would not spend eternity in flames. Much worse flames, they thought, than the ones that he was standing in at the time. And the inquisitors genuinely believed they were showing mercy. If you want to find the person who is most likely to destroy freedom of speech, listen for someone who talks endlessly about freedom of speech. There was a freedom of speech movement in the 1960s on the University of California campus where students were using filthy language. Those were the same people who got my professors fired for being conservatives at the University of Virginia. As I said, two of those professors, they were all tenured, by the way, later on won Nobel Prizes in economics. But the leftists who screamed freedom of speech in the 1960s did a lot more than that to suppress freedom of speech. There had never been a time before that in American history. Before the 1960s, when freedom of speech was so completely suppressed for anyone who did not agree with the radical agenda. And of course, we all know today that the last place you're going to find freedom of expression or freedom of thought is a university campus. Unless, of course, you agree with everything political correctness says. This is not, as many people seem to think when they send each other frantic emails, this is not a novel situation that someone keeps talking about democracy and freedom and is out to destroy democracy and freedom. The communists talked about democracy and freedom all the time. This is not an unusual situation. This is a routine situation. People who talk about hate all the time, hate all the time. The people they're accusing of hatred don't really understand what they're talking about. But they use the word all the time because it happens to be a very realistic motivation to the people who scream hate all the time. They actually do operate on hate all the time. The people who talk about diversity, as we all know, are the people who will not allow the slightest diversity of opinion, and their long-term aim in talking about diversity is to get rid of the multiple cultures and enforce one multiculture. We know that their aim is to take all the white countries and make sure that they end up being one uniform brown country. This is not a contradiction. This is not novel. This is routine. And if that is the only thing you learn listening to this, it will be a terrifically valuable lesson for you to learn from this old man who has been many places and done many things. The difference between a joke and criticism and hate is something any rational person understands. Once I was at a party on Capitol Hill, and I was talking to a member of the Black Caucus, and I said, you know, what I really don't understand about people in the Black Caucus is, you spent all those years fighting because black people kept being looked down on and insulted, and people didn't think much of them. And I said, if you don't want to belong to a group that people don't think much of and insult all the time, why in the hell did you become a politician? Well, he laughed at that. He said, you know, I've never looked at it quite that way, but you got a good point. And a few minutes later, I saw him talking to one of his staffers. Obviously, he was telling the staffer what I had said. The staffer laughed and grinned at me. After all, politician was the minority group that everybody in that room belonged to. We knew very well what people in general think of politicians and what they say about politicians. One time I was sitting around shooting the breeze with some other guys on Capitol Hill, and on Capitol Hill, when you do get a chance to relax, you have a tendency to make jokes about things you wouldn't put in a political speech. And I happened to say, well, just as a matter of principle, I wouldn't date a girl of another race. A black buddy of mine from Mississippi had been laying for me on that one. And he turned around to me and he said, and Bob, I want you to know we appreciate it too. Now, he wasn't insulting me. He wasn't calling me a bigot. He was just enjoying catching me out. But when I was a little boy, one incident occurred because of this inability of people to tell the difference between a joke, criticism, and hate. It really hurt me and hurt some other people, too. That was about the show Amos and Andy. The brick plant that I was raised on was way out in the sand hills. Most of the workers there were black. And when I got home from school, the only people I had to play with were the little black boys there, since they were the only ones the same age I was. And we had the only TV set in the area. We're talking about the 1950s. And every week, when Amos and Andy was on, they would come over to our house, lay there on the rug with me, and my parents and whoever was there would be watching the show too. And we all had a grand old time watching Amos and Andy. Of course, they were fascinated by the fact that the show was all black. But there was something else they were fascinated by too. When poor old Kingfish went to court, which he had a tendency to do a lot, the judge there was a highly educated black man in his robes. The court recorder was black. Everybody in that courtroom was black, highly educated. When they showed a doctor, the doctor was black, highly educated. And this was quite a treat for these little black boys way out in the sand hills of South Carolina. But you won't be able to see any reruns of Amos and Andy now because it was considered a bigoted show. The reason it was considered a bigoted show was because the black comic characters on Amos and Andy didn't look real bright. Now, down here on Earth, I think we all realize that comic characters never look real bright. I think if you judge the white race by the intelligence level of Laurel and Hardy or Buster Keaton, you wouldn't have much of an opinion of us. But that doesn't upset people much. On Amos and Andy, a few comic characters look pretty stupid. Andy actually was on the television program. Andy was transformed into the cabbie, very intelligent guy who would introduce the program, and he has some very touching scenes with his son in the show. And the substitute for him was one of the greatest comic actors I've ever seen, and I don't remember his name, but he was called the Kingfish, and he played that role to the hilt. Oh, Andy was a fat guy who was always a sucker. He looked stupid. And what the NAACP really was upset about was the lawyer Calhoun, who was like Oliver Hardy. He was the dumb guy who thought he was smart. Remember that the NAACP was largely an organization run by lawyers, most of them black. So this comedy show committed this horrible action of having some black characters who look stupid. Well, even Bill Cosby, when he was playing a doctor married to a judge on his show, when he was playing his comedy parts, he didn't look real bright. Doctors don't look bright all the time. Ask a doctor. Lawyers don't look bright all the time. Ask a lawyer. The comic parts is when they're acting stupid. But all the NAACP saw was that here were some black people looking stupid. If you ever watch Sanford and Son, you will find that the average IQ represented on Sanford and Son is not exactly genius, and it was a brilliant comedy show. It was a comedy show, gang. Anyway, what happened was that the NAACP finally got Amos and Andy banned off the air because of those comic characters that were appearing on a comedy show. I had to tell these black kids that Amos and Andy was no longer on the air. A couple of them actually broke down and cried. The others looked like they wanted to break down and cry, although we didn't cry in front of each other much. But it was hard for me. I remember walking down there when I had to tell these kids that Amos and Andy wouldn't be on anymore. And I'm sure they thought that what had happened was that white folks weren't going to allow black folks to have their own show on television. I couldn't really explain to them what the politics of the thing was and that we had nothing to do with it. That the NAACP had gotten Amos and Andy banned. Every white person they knew enjoyed Amos and Andy a lot. But this was one of my earliest experiences with the complete inability of people to come down to the real world and tell the difference between humor, criticism, and hate. The NAACP honestly believed that Amos and Andy, one of the most innocent programs ever made, was a hate show. I wish the listeners to this show, especially the black listeners, would get one of the bootleg copies that are available on the internet of the Amos and Andy show and take a look at it. And I wish you would put yourself in the position of a little black kid out in the sand hills of South Carolina watching that show. And if you can't do it, ask your grandfather. He can tell you about it. There was not a shabbily dressed person on the entire show. Even the Kingfish, the comic character, who thought a lot of himself, he had on a Stetson hat and a vest, and he was dressed like a Kingfish. And except for the comic characters, who had their sympathetic moments too, like all comic characters do, everybody there spoke perfectly good English, and today they certainly outclass the black characters presented on the average black comedy. The 50s were a more formal time, and people were not presented as running around shabby, or using foul language, or being bad. They were innocent, at least on television. It was an innocent time. They were basically, all of them, good people. And I think that anybody who actually watches any episode of Amos and Andy will wonder why in heaven's name a program of that quality was taken off the air. Well, it was taken off the air because people cannot tell the difference between comedy, criticism, and hatred. And a society that can't tell the difference between comedy, criticism, and hatred is a very sick society indeed. A lot of white people have trouble talking with black people because they watch black leaders talking on television, and they have the impression that every person with a black skin is walking around with a chip on his shoulder the size of Mount Everest. Now, there's no doubt about it. Black people have a lot to complain about. But they also live on the same planet we do. And they are not like the spokesmen you see on television. The spokesmen you see on television are getting paid to express black resentment. The average black person does not want to spend his entire life talking about nothing but black resentment. I find it much easier to crack jokes with a working man, be he black or white, than I do with the average suburbanite, who is really uptight. When the NAACP destroyed Amos and Andy, they also destroyed the careers of several really great black actors. Now, I believe that every black actor who appeared in Amos and Andy was probably put into the category that in a communist country would be called an enemy of the people. That is to say, he couldn't appear on any show without reminding people of this bigoted, hate-filled, vicious program that all decent people rejected, called Amos and Andy. In fact, the only black actor from that program I ever saw again was the man who played Andy, and he had about a 30-second role as a butler in some program. I never saw the Kingfish again. I never saw Andy again. But then again, I'm not an expert on theater. I wish them well. But once you have shown up on a program that is banned as hate, you don't have much of a career ahead of you. This reminds me of another point, and that is that in Europe, if you say the wrong thing, the police simply arrest you. I'm not talking about Nazi Germany. I'm talking about today. In America, the Gestapo doesn't wear black uniforms. I remember that Alan Dershowitz once was a very effective member of the American Thought Police. At least, I remember the one incident I saw of it. I'm sure there are other incidents. But he was appearing on a talk program, and one gentleman said, Alan Dershowitz has devoted his life to protecting criminals. Alan Dershowitz turned around to him and said, you'd better not say that again before you put your house in your wife's name. A good, solid, secret police threat. Alan Dershowitz could file cases in his spare time and destroy this man, and the man backed down immediately. Now, Alan Dershowitz is always the great civil libertarian who is defending the rights of people to burn the American flag or curse or whatever they want to. But he's also a lawyer, and he can financially destroy someone simply by filing cases against them and forcing them to hire lawyers at the kind of rates that Alan Dershowitz charges. That is terror. That is a threat. It happens to be true that defending the rights, quote-unquote, of criminals is what Alan Dershowitz has devoted his lifetime to. The next time you hear of someone being beaten to death in the streets by a career criminal, one of the peoples you can thank is Alan Dershowitz, and we all know it. But you're not allowed to say that, because Alan Dershowitz will get you, just like a member of any other secret police will get you. Punishment he has is to destroy your career, to destroy you financially. But every time Alan Dershowitz is introduced, he is introduced as a great civil libertarian, a defender of the rights of Americans, the right of free speech. Well, he'll certainly defend any free speech he particularly likes, but the Alan Dershowitz I saw was using a threat to keep a man from saying what he was thinking and what I am thinking. People concentrate way too much on the strictly secret police methods of suppressing freedom of speech and other freedoms. I happen to think that O.J. Simpson was as guilty as sin, but I am very upset at the fact that he was tried twice for the same crime. He was taken to civil court and convicted there, although you don't use the word convicted, and that's supposed to make all the difference. I do not approve of the fact that the policemen who were acquitted in the Rodney King trial were then tried for the same crime under the federal law and again for the same crime in civil court. The Constitution forbids double jeopardy, and that means all double jeopardy. If you can be destroyed financially for saying the wrong thing, you do not have freedom of speech. It doesn't matter whether the person who is using the law to punish you wears a coat and tie or a Gestapo outfit. Now, as it happens, the polls show a majority of black people think that O.J. Simpson was innocent and resent his being taken to civil court on the same charge. And a majority of black people think that the police who beat Rodney King were guilty. On the other hand, a majority of white people feel that O.J. Simpson was guilty and the police who beat Rodney King were innocent. This makes my point. It doesn't make any difference which position you take on those particular cases. We had better all get together and stand as a united front against censorship, whether that censorship is civilian or police, and we had better unite as Americans against double jeopardy. It doesn't matter against whom that double jeopardy is being practiced. We should all know that once you begin breaking the rules of simple decency, once you begin saying that people are not allowed to say certain things, all of us are going to live under a tyranny.